All right, and Dr. Grant, who is a general and endocrine surgeon in New York.
Thank you. And thank you for the privilege of the podium. I'm actually going to start by saying that I think that pro and con debates at an ethics session are great because they're very engaging. But within ethics, I think that you can have two people who are very well informed on an issue and both have reasonable perspectives. And so I don't think that there's necessarily a right and wrong. And I think that often when we do the pro and con, the answer is somewhere in the middle. And so I will have my presentation go in that direction a little bit. So just in terms of disclosures, I'm on the American College of Surgeons Ethics Committee as the Resident Associate Society Liaison and the Association for Academic Surgery Ethics Committee, but these are not the views of either of those, these are mine. And since this is a talk on sort of financial topics, I'm including this, which is from the Center for Medicare Services Open Payments Database. In 2014, I have a $20.05 thing to my name from when I went to a Pacira lecture on Expiril. So that's my financial disclosure. So we already heard the case. I'm going to kind of move forward. And I'm just going to set a little bit of the stage for this in terms of the background of why this is the case that we're discussing. So U.S. healthcare spending grew 4.3% in 2016, reaching $3.3 trillion, or $10,348 per person. And as a share of the nation's gross domestic product, it's accounting for 17.9%, up from 17.7% the year before. To offset the rising costs, deductibles, copayments, and other out-of-pocket expenses, many insurance plans are going to cost shifting, where patients become more price-sensitive consumers, although sometimes this also has unintended consequences where patients are too frugal to the detriment of their own health. Health insurance premiums, as we all know, are rising and rising at a rate that's far outpacing inflation and wage gains. And it's become the largest issue in collective bargaining at a time when the number of unions in this country is decreasing. So this is a slide showing healthcare spending as a percentage of GDP over about the last 33 years. And you can see that the U.S. has become very much an outlier. And one thing that I wanted to say in the context of this slide, based on the case, was the patient has a $10,000 deductible and a $45,000 annual salary. And if you do the math on that, it's 22.2%, which actually is not so different from our current 17.1% of GDP spending on healthcare. This shows our national health expenditures as a share of gross domestic product. And again, you can see it's just going up and up and up. And this just quickly shows how we're spending that money, and the largest percentage is on hospital care. Okay, so again, just framing the problem unique to this case, many Americans are one diagnosis away from financial catastrophe, and even with health insurance, the high costs of surgical care and cancer care, as I'll give you an example of later, are leaving some vulnerable families adrift in debt. Many patients are forced to deplete their savings, sell their homes, and/or declare bankruptcy. And actually, healthcare expenses are the number one cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. They must choose literally between their money and their lives. And research shows that patients worry that broaching the topic of finances with their physician will somehow compromise their treatment, or that their physician won't be willing or able to help. And I'll also present a little bit of data on that topic. So just to lay out some of the ethical considerations here, high out-of-pocket costs are associated with delaying treatment, non-adherence, problems paying medical bills, and create the patient experience of financial burden, including the possibility of high interest rate debt, such as credit card debt, and thus the risk of credit score damage, bankruptcy, all of which adversely affect health. And barriers to having discussions about how much care costs or how much diagnostic workup costs include discomfort discussing financial issues, at least a claim of insufficient time, and a belief that there are not viable solutions to patients' concerns. And I think a big part of it's actually also a lack of training during residency and fellowship on having these conversations. There's Also, from an ethics standpoint, a question of inequality and access. If we do have these conversations, are we going to disenfranchise the poor, whereas the wealthy will be able to continue to receive the highest level of care? And insurance companies have now turned to blaming patients for wanting too much care and being heedless of costs. It's sort of a moral hazard argument that because you have sort of unlimited access to services, so you think you're going to utilize more of them. So this is a paper that came out in 2003 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where they did paired surveys of 133 general internists and 484 outpatients at three academic centers and 18 community medical practices in the Chicago area. And they found that 63% of patients reported a desire to talk with their physician about out-of-pocket costs, and 79% of physicians believed that patients in general want to discuss costs. 90% of physicians said that they should consider patients' out-of-pocket costs as they make clinical decisions. However, only 35% of physicians and 15% of patients reported ever having discussed these issues. Let me just repeat those numbers. 90% of physicians think that they should talk about it, but only 35% of the time did physicians say they did talk about it, and patients said that it only happened 15% of the time. And this was sort of the first paper, at least that I could find, of sort of a discussion or at least research looking at physicians' practices of whether or not they had these conversations. And I would argue that probably not that much has actually changed in terms of how we think about our sort of need or desire from patients' perspectives to provide this information. And also not much has changed in terms of how often these conversations are happening. This is an article from the New York Times from August 11th, 2002. And it says, a decade after a healthcare crisis, soaring costs bring new strains. My point in putting this slide up is that this is not a new issue. It has a quote from the article that, in a struggling economy, many employers say they can no longer simply absorb these higher costs and thus pass more of them on to employees. And again, my point is that this was not an article from last year. This didn't occur in some ivory tower journal. This is an issue that's been in the public forefront for going on at least 15 years and probably much longer. And the article specifically mentions another point that I've sort of alluded to earlier, which is it mentions that delaying treatment is typical of the uninsured, according to the Institute of Medicine, which in a report concluded that as many as 18,000 Americans died prematurely each year as a result of not having health coverage. This article on out-of-pocket spending was in JAMA Oncology, and they found that among the five health conditions that contribute most to healthcare costs in the U.S., per person direct medical expenditures on cancer are the highest, so much of the financial toxicity literature has been centered in the field of oncology. And the sort of design of this study was a prospectively collected data from 18,166 Medicare beneficiaries, including 1,409 who were diagnosed with cancer during the study period from 2002 to 2012. The data was collected from the Health and Retirement Study, which is nationally representative and looks at people who are greater than 50 years old. I'll skip some of the details of the study, but their primary outcome was looking at out-of-pocket expenditures, and their secondary outcome was financial burden, basically looking at what percentage of your income was included, what percentage of your expenditures were compared to your annual income. So this is a little bit busy of a slide, but their key finding was that depending on the type of insurance that you have, in addition to Medicare, determines basically how much your out-of-pocket costs will likely be. And you can see in sort of the first column highlighted with the blue rectangle that it can range from $2,116 all the way up to $8,115 depending on whether you have Medicaid or no additional insurance. They also looked at the financial burden. And again, if you look at the sort of red rectangle at the bottom, it was 23.7% of people's annual income that was spent on healthcare as a mean. And if you look on the far right, it shows what the 90th percentile was. And it was $17,866 if you didn't have any additional insurance, or 63.1% of your annual income. So just in terms of questions for the audience, I'll try to do this quickly. Do you know how much these tests cost at your institution? I can't say that I do. And in terms of your ethical obligations, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the patient, but that includes two things. One is non-maleficence. Does this include doing no harm to the patient's financial health? I think that's an open question. Obviously, beneficence and respect for autonomy, which includes potentially the decision to forego recommended diagnostic workup and treatment if it's unaffordable or creates an unacceptable financial burden.
Thank you, Dr. Grant. We'll have to stop there in the interest of time, and we're going to have a counterpoint with Dr. Catherine Hunter, who is a pediatric surgeon in Chicago.
Well, my colleague said that he was reasonable and would find a balanced view. I'm not going to be so reasonable. I'm going to address the point that I was assigned. And already 75% if you were in agreement, so I think let's bring the other 25% over so we can really get a quorum on this. All right. So my point is that the surgeon must consider and adapt the workup to accommodate the financial toxicity of the patient. Let's just take a second. Sarah, she's a 61 administrative assistant. This is definitely somebody that we could all individually know. This is a real life example. This could be a lady who works in our office. She has a really common disease, and as was mentioned, a bronze level insurance plan. These exist. This is a real thing for people out there in the community who are working. And just because you have insurance, that's not like a golden egg where it's going to pay for everything. So this is something that we really have to consider. So where are we now? There have been remarkable advances in the diagnosis and treatment of disease. It really has been impressive how we've improved survival in our patients, as well as improving their general outcomes. There's been a lot of public policy debate regarding how to focus on the uninsured and provide care for that particular population and allocate those finite healthcare resources. However, the mere possession of health insurance does not actually protect patients at all from the devastating financial consequences of their diseases, the diseases that we as surgeons are treating. These can result in a high degree of financial burden, and some of the data surrounding that was presented briefly by Dr. Grant. And also, something else I think is really important to consider is that financial toxicity may actually affect compliance with the treatments that we're offering and prescribing to patients, and actually negatively affect our patients' outcomes. So if we want our patients to do well, we really have to consider this as part of their care. So what are the causes of the financial toxicity? We've reviewed these. It's out-of-pocket costs like co-payments and deductibles and the co-insurance, and these just add up and add up. Loss of income, you're sick, you can't go to work, you're not going to make money. This dramatically affects people. Also, you might need to have somebody take a day off work to take you somewhere for one of these tests. That's also another cost to people. It's the objective and subjective financial concerns that ultimately contribute to this term financial toxicity. So what's been the impact of payment for service? Well, as out-of-pocket expenses have increased, a patient's willingness to accept treatments that only have low to modest benefits may actually decline. And don't you think the patient has the right to actually know if the test or procedure that you're recommending is only of a low benefit? I'd want to know. We also know that payment for services have been criticized, although not for people in this room, I'm sure, as providing strong financial incentive for providers to overtreat or overuse imaging. We don't want to do that. So let's understand the financial health of Sarah. She makes $45,000 a year. So after taxes, that's $35,665 of take-home pay. Yeah, okay, not much. Oh wait, you've got that $10,000 deductible. That's $25,665 to take home. Can she live on this amount of money? Well, I took the liberty of looking at CNBC. And I pulled up 8 large cities. And please note that I'm not including cities like Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York, which can be even triple the amount of this. Let's just go through this. That's the average cost, 32. I'm not going to read these off, 32,587. Even more in Columbus. Jacksonville, I don't think of that as a very expensive city to live in, but guess what? It's a lot more than this lady can afford. Indianapolis, Dallas, Houston, Phoenix, and my home city, Chicago. If she has to pay out of pocket that $10,000 on what she's living on, she is going to be in a serious financial deficit. She's going to have a huge debt that she's taking on that's basically about a third of her salary. So what are our barriers to assessing financial health if we all accept that something that's important and relevant in this patient's life and also potentially in their outcomes? Well, time. I don't know about you, but sometimes I only have 15 minutes, 20 minutes to see a patient. Do I really have time to sit down and get into what their pocketbook says? Not always. Also, you don't want to offend the patient. It kind of feels dirty talking about money. I don't really like to do it myself, but it doesn't mean that I shouldn't do it. So I'm going to offer a couple of strategies for how we should approach this. It can be a difficult subject to broach. And also, one of the things that I've heard from people is, well, there's not really a good objective measurement of this. I don't really know what it means. I can't calculate it for everybody. Well, I'm going to argue that there actually is an objective measurement. There's a thing called the Comprehensive Score for Financial Toxicity. This was a metric that was developed by Dr. Sousa et al. To assess financial toxicity actually in cancer patients. They looked at 155 patients with cancer and interviewed them to develop these 11 cost measurements. And I think this is pretty easily adaptable to just about all of our patients. It's a patient-reported outcome measurement. This is it here. So it's really simple questions such as, I know that I have enough money in savings. My out-of-pocket medical expenses are more than I thought they would be. Isn't this something that we could probably hand out to patients while they're in our waiting room and have them fill it out so that patients that we thought were maybe at high risk of financial toxicity, we could at least flag them and maybe spend the extra 5 minutes trying to address whether or not this was something that we really should be considering for our patients? I would argue that it is. We also took an oath to do no harm. If we know that financial toxicity, financial stress, financial hardship, financial burden, and economic hardship is detrimental to our patients, isn't the fact that we would be ignoring it and allowing additional hardship and suffering to occur for our patients really unethical? I feel that it is. Yes, there are a number of ethical issues. In this country, we value patient autonomy. We also hold informed decision-making very, very highly within our healthcare service. Isn't this something that should be considered, that when we're making an informed decision with our patients, that when we're helping them make that informed decision, that we're able to include all of the data that's important for them? I think so. And it's up to us to guide the patient and help them understand so that they can assume the path that's best for them and the path that they wish to take. So I would agree with the 75% of the audience and encourage that remaining 25% to go with the discuss each test and its cost with the patient. However, as surgeons, we may not know the exact cost of each test, but it is our responsibility to have an idea and not be fiscally irresponsible for our patients. We should be able to acknowledge the impact of financial toxicity on our patients' lives and tailor the workup accordingly to provide the safest and most efficient approach possible. It may be considered an extension of the informed consent process and transparency regarding the potential therapeutic benefit that we may provide and the cost is a very reasonable discussion point. Perhaps we could also direct our patients to resources within our offices and our hospitals to further discuss these issues in a detail that we may not have in our actual clinic setting. So do surgeons have a duty to control costs? I would say yes, they do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hunter. So I'd like to invite Dr. Weiser to discuss this case.
So Dr. Grant and Dr. Hunter, thank you. Beautifully well done. I'm going to start off much more concrete and then digress, as I tend to do. So physicians and surgeons absolutely have a responsibility to take the entirety of a patient into consideration when they treat someone. So the simple question is, yes, you consider everything. That said, any diagnostic testing that is critical to an accurate diagnosis, the accurate development of a differential diagnosis, and the appropriate treatment of a patient isn't absolute. That's not even on the table. Things that have to be done for quality patient care have to be done. The corollary of that is that non-essential testing should be avoided in almost every situation, irregardless of whether the patient can pay for it or not. And that's a significant part of the problem. Just because someone can afford it is not an indication to get a test. The very concept of profession has to do with a contract with society, so physicians and surgeons are completely appropriate in this sphere. Now let me get a little more concrete. There's a whole lot involved in this. Part of it is your ability to diagnose. I think it's telling that there's no discussion of this patient's physical exam. Was she jaundiced? Did she have an epigastric mass? Was she tender? Did she ever have liver function tests? These are inexpensive things. And I think what there was a guy, Sir Zachary Cope, he wrote a whole book on the diagnosis of the abdomen, and then he had so much time he wrote it again in rhyme. Not being a good diagnostician is not a reason to start getting a lot of tests. And I know that sounds artificial, but I think that there's really some truth in that. So we have a responsibility to be exceptional diagnosticians. Technical skill has part to do with this. Why are you getting these tests? The assumption here is that this woman has gallstones. So I guess the concern is, does she have a common bile duct stone? Then the question is, are you skilled enough, if you find that intraoperatively, to perform an intraoperative cholangiogram? Can you explore the common bile duct? What if you find a cancer of the head of the pancreas or a tumor of the small bowel? Getting these tests isn't going to change what is. She's got what she's got, and getting the tests is not an excuse for not being able to deal with what you find during the surgery. Long ago, when I was involved in this kind of surgery, I remember every time we opened the abdomen, it was an exploration. You ran the bowel, you felt the liver, you palpated the spleen, you looked in the lesser sac, you figured out you're trying to make a diagnosis. So testing is not, again, an excuse for being a poor diagnostician or not having the technical skills to take care of it. Part of that is also having the knowledge and skill to pull out. If what you find is not what you expected, then you need to have the knowledge and skill to back out and not do any harm. I don't know if it's still done, but in the old days you could drain things, you could put in a T-tube. There are options that would buy some time until you could figure out what you needed to do. Remember that testing isn't all that accurate. It's pretty good. I don't mean to put it down, but a lot of this stuff didn't even exist 20 years ago. And you are kidding yourself if you absolutely trust any diagnostic test. You still have to enter an operation being prepared to deal with whatever you find. And then finally, I'm going to absolutely digress and say, you know, we live in a country where being a professional athlete, you can make $100 million a year. You can be a CEO and make $100 million a year. Should we live in a society where any human being can face absolute financial devastation through medical illness? And I think as physicians and surgeons that we have a right to be in that space, and I would encourage you to get into that space.
Fabulous. All right. So Dr. Britt looks like he's dying to say something, but I bet there are other people in the audience who would also like to make a comment or a question. So I'm going to give the microphone to Dr. Britt, who needs it right now, and then open it right up after that.
I don't need it right now, but I'm just confused. 90%, 85 to 90% of diagnosis can be made by history and physical exam. I was almost incontinent when I saw the physical exam not on this list.
That's because a vascular surgeon wrote the cases.
And having said that, at the end of the day, this patient had physical findings consistent with acute cholecystitis. With an ultrasound, I would operate on the patient. Let me say it again. I would operate on the patient and would not lose any sleep and would likely be right with my diagnosis.
I love that. Dr. Singer.
Dr. Britt, as a urologist, I can see you later today. I didn't say where I was in contact.
I'll let you know.
So interestingly, actually in the American Urological Association Code of Ethics, discussing financial costs is actually in our Code of Ethics, so that's part of it. The American Society of Clinical Oncology has written several papers for resource-limited countries. Should we essentially adopt that kind of mentality for the United States, where we would say, this is the ideal set of treatments and evaluations, this is what if you can't do that, this is what if you can't do that, yes or no? Discuss. Thank you so much.
Well, being a CEO, and we had $200 million of uninsured care last year and $90 million of deductibles not paid at Wake Forest Baptist. So $300 million I did not have, so my margin was less than a percentage. So what we're doing is finding resources for these patients in the elective setting, which this patient, sort of in the middle. I mean, you have I wasn't quite sure what the disease was either, but if it was cholecystitis, you have to go forward. But we are finding them resources in the community. We're giving them payment plans without interest so they can pay our deductible over time. And we're also asking the question, are you still uninsured? We're so pleasant and nice in the South. If you were uninsured last year, we didn't ask you if you got a job and had insurance. We just assumed you were uninsured and you didn't tell us. So I think you can come up with many ways to help people. The only good statistic I've heard recently is 10 years ago, if you asked the United States, is healthcare a right? About a third of us said yes. Now it's over 70%. And I think that is because of expansion and people realizing there's so many other determinants of health. And also, we're a Medicaid non-expansive state, too, and it's devastating. So I think the answer is yes. I would say there's this that you get to do. We actually were doing cosmetic surgery in uninsured patients for training purposes because we needed that. We can't do that. You know, if we did that, maybe I should have that done. But I think you need to have this piece that when people need procedures, they should have them done. There are resources in your community. And also, you can have payment plans to help people get there.
We are fortunate to have the modern-day icon of ethics, Ira Cotner, coming to the mic for those who don't know him.
Thank you. I'm from Washington University in St. Louis. I'm going to render part of this discussion ludicrous. What I'm going to say comes from a group I work with in St. Louis dealing with the possibilities of single-payer system. So as you present the choices for this patient for your diagnostic test, I'll challenge all of you to go back to your home institution and ask for their list of prices for the diagnostic tests. And I challenge you, you will not get that list because the hospitals do not publish what their costs are.
Except so, now we're going to be forced to do it next year. Everyone has to have them out in 2019.
Is that right?
Yes, and actually we're very anxious about it, but everybody has, because everybody's turned into a consumer.
And is that we, all of us in the United States?
Yes.
Dr. Freischlag, like, what prices are you gonna put out there?
We have to, it's not that I get to choose. It's what you're charging for procedures and every diagnostic test. It can be found so that people will know.
No matter what the insurance coverage is.
Right.
That's a charge center price?
So you're actually going to publish costs.
You're going to publish charges.
And it's not going to vary. Because the way it is now, the analogy is going into an elegant restaurant and having dinner and then finding out what everything costs.
Yeah. Well, and right. This is the first step, right? And actually, maybe people are consumers. They're looking. They assume all the doctors are the same and very equal, and they're looking for costs. So perhaps, as we do look at our charges, we'll make them more managed with the costs. But you're absolutely right. It's a game. We all play a game as far as what people pay
so
us.
So as we surgeons advise for now, I would suggest ask what the costs are for your institution. Mm-hmm. And I'll also tell you won't get them.
Another comment from the audience. Fantastic.
I'm Dr. Rao, practicing for the last 35 years in Albany area. I just want to know what is the opinion of the panelists about controlling the cost of the medical care. The cost of the medical care is going up about 7-8 times more than the inflation rate. Did they ever control these tort reforms? Because all politicians are attorneys. And that never got it. There is a product liability cost, there is a research cost, and there is also easily about 20,000 lawsuits against each of the tertiary centers, and they have to pay for that one. And how can this keep on going up 17%, 18% per year, the cost of medical care, while the salaries and other criteria for the patient salary are not able to catch up with it?
Right.
And what about the Medicaid? Medicaid takes away a lot of money in certain states. How do they control and assess it rather than welfare? More for workfare. Thank you.
So clearly cost is a tricky problem. Additional comments from the panel?
Only that it's the whole thing is artificial. I mean, the whole thing is artificial. It's worth what it is. And again, it will take some significant changes to fix that problem.
Great. One last call from the audience, and we'll have our final question for this case.
I'm Joyce Duane, and my financial disclosures, I was trained by L.D. Britt. So I just want to pose an alternative that is taking a lot of getting a lot of traction in primary care. My sister is a primary care doctor that practices direct primary care. And what that means is that her patients pay her $80 a month for 100% access to her time. When they need something, she says, this is the discounted cost I can get it at. Your child needs an immunization. It's not $100, it's $5. Do you want to pay for it or don't you want to pay for it? And it's working very well. The reality is there are surgeons in this country that are providing the same service, and instead of being concerned that the government we're not expanding government services, that's not the solution. It's not a single payer system that we need. We need a million people payer system in which the patient is actually paying for the product that they're buying. And we're getting rid of the middleman and doing ourselves, thereby leaving insurance only to catastrophic events. And when you do that, you're going to see our numbers change. I applaud our primary care physicians for doing it and leading the way, and for some of the general surgeons who are in the communities who are doing it themselves. They're doing it with gallbladders, doing it with cancer surgeries, doing it with breast surgeries, and the patients are paying for exactly what they use and getting rid of all the fluff. It's out of the box, but I would encourage everybody to look into it because I think this is where we need to go in the future. Thank you.
Fantastic. All right, here's our post-presentation question. Let's see if we change this. This was the one that was even across the board. Whoa, that is very impressive.